Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 30th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Facing the Fire, Beauty and Terror in Liturgy and Life, presented by Ben Stewart. Disc number STB-2005-04.
I don't want to begin yet with a preface of what we're doing, other than just to thank you for being here. This is the time of day when monks tended to think the devil was most active, because it's the kind of lethargic time of the day, and, you know, we're either falling asleep or giving in to temptation, so thanks for being here. Before we say much about what we're up to today, can you read this list of words?
Yeah.
Awe, piercing, dumbstruck, silenced, breathtaking, overwhelming, stunning, disarming, arresting. I wonder, without giving long stories, if you can just, can we call out some times in our lives, some images, when we've felt like this, when we've had this experience?
Childbirth.
Backpacking.
When I put Steen's Mountain and went down about 1,000 feet down into the Alvord Desert.
Whoa.
Like standing on holy.
Okay, ground. Looking over a big precipice. Mm-hmm. Okay. Other people.
Weddings.
First Eucharist in a new church.
Mont Saint-Michel.
Oh, okay.
I've had a few, being a musician, I've had a few musical ones.
Ah, in music, yeah. Has anyone experienced a friend who's died? Is that my son's best friend died suddenly and tragically in Philadelphia the week before we were to leave there, just last year about this time. Yeah. That's where I was. Other times, you want to name a few more? Anybody else?
9/11.
Yeah. Okay. We named here with these things here, these descriptions, both kind of ecstatic, wonderful, beautiful experiences we'd want to repeat, and some we never want to repeat again. An interesting kind of connection between these two experiences of what we're going to call today beauty and terror. The way I now preface this session is like, of all the things I've been teaching this week, this is the one I feel least prepared to talk about. And I was feeling nervous about that, but then when I realized the kind of things that you all just named, if you ever think you've mastered those topics, you should stop teaching, because they are by definition the biggest things that we always, at best, kind of understand in the sense of standing under them and not over them. A Bible. Does someone have a Bible out there?
Right. Look,
we've got one right here. How about a little Exodus? It's a theme text. Exodus 3, 2 through 6.
There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He, being Moses, looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. And then he said, Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. Further, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God.
How would you describe this situation? Is it beautiful? Is it terrifying? What's going on? What do you think? How's Moses feeling here?
Dumbstruck.
Yeah, literally. What else?
Overwhelmed.
Overwhelmed? What's his body doing? What did he do with his body?
Turned away.
Hid his face. Was scared to look at it. Was instructed to take off his shoes. There's a line from one of Rilke's poems that says, "Beauty is nothing but the beginning of terror." And my advisor, actually in graduate school, has been writing a bit on this, and he's trying to make the case that our kind of emotional response to the very things that this group mentioned that are beautiful and terrifying, that there's an emotional intelligence in that. That kind of mouth-shutting, dumb-striking, face-hiding, take-off-your-shoes response to things that we feel in our bodies, first of all, towers toppling. That in that, there's a kind of intelligence that's evaluating the world, saying, this matters. And it's important to take that moment and do some processing around it rather than rushing into some other thing before we take time to kind of deal with it. Now, another way to kind of look at this, Paul Tillich described God in kind of phenomenal terms as whatever is ultimate to us, what our ultimate concern is, what's most important, the ground of our being. So all these beautiful and terrifying experiences can be something like, another phrase that Tillich used, the shaking of our foundations, the shaking of the ground of our being. Don Saliers, Paul Tillich, Moses, God seem to want to have us pay attention to these moments. I'm thinking of, I forget which poem it is, but it's by Mary Oliver, and she says, "I don't know what it is to pray, but I do know what it is to pay attention." And I think dear Mary Oliver is being a little coy there, because I think she does know what it is to pray, which is to pay attention deeply to the world. So here's some things that we want to do, or that I want to have us do with this today. There are two ways that when we talk about these kind of experiences, they can mostly, even though we've talked about beauty and terror, EAU, right? Beauty and terror. These two things we experience in ways, at least we can divide it into two different ways. We could say, what befalls us? And then, what we attend to. What I think is interesting is that the way let's think about the beautiful and terrifying in our lives. First of all, can you think about going to art museums or to the symphony? We already talked a little bit about music and art, and aren't those the kind of things that generally kind of draw us in? Obviously the beautiful we think about, but also the terrifying. Some of Mahler's symphonies, some artwork that seems, that comes out of maybe the world wars, we're drawn into those and we attend to those. What's going on in there and what are we learning? Are we learning how to kind of evaluate what's valuable in the world? What I want to do now is have us read a few things that I think can take us deeper into the sense of beauty and terror in literature. And then what I want to do is say, how can liturgy or worship hold these things there and help us prepare, if we attend to these things in liturgy intentionally, does that kind of train us in a way? Can liturgy be a school? Can art be a school? So that when these things befall us, beauty and terror, unbidden, when they surprise us, are we prepared to respond in a different way? One example, utterly partisan example, when President Bush climbed up on the ruins of those towers and took a megaphone and started the people chanting, USA, USA. And he talked about these towers that had fallen down, and then began threatening people that we were going to come knock down their buildings. My question is, what had he attended to before that that prepared him so that when those buildings fell down, that was the response that he had? What would prepare us to have a different response than violence when buildings fall down? What would prepare us to be grateful in the face of beauty so that we don't simply want to consume it, but that we might give thanks for it? I'll show my hand a little bit here, but like this old posture of prayer in the church, the Orans posture, I think could be a beautiful sign of the way the liturgy might train us to respond to these events. It's a ancient stance of thanksgiving for goodness. Our hands are empty, though. We're thankful for this. It can also be a sign of utter helplessness and a plea to God. I mean, picture this on the ruins of the Twin Towers. Arms empty, upheld, asking for God's help, for God's mercy, but no weapons in these hands, just simply a prayer. Beauty and terror, both prayed through in this posture. Can the liturgy teach us to attend to these moments? So, any questions or thoughts before we dive into some poems and prayers? Okay. Kata, do you want to read the one that you brought in here? Kata found this today.
It's called Summer, and it's by Tony Hoagland.
Would you read it loud, sister?
Read what? Loud, right. God moves mysterious thunderheads over the towns and office buildings, cracks them open like raw eggs. The north has critical humidity. The south plucks at its sweaty clothes. The weatherman says it's August, and a sniper is haunting Washington, D.C. He's picking victims at random from shopping malls and parking lots, touching them with bullets like blue fingertips. And some say he's an unemployed geek with a chip on his shoulder, and some say he's an agent of ancient Greek theology. Gibb says the sniper is a surrealist travel agent booking departures only. Or he's a Dada lawyer without a client, arguing in 30 caliber sentences. Robin says the sniper is what the country invented as a symptom of its mental illness. Marcia is sad because she knows the sniper could have been cured by a regimen of vitamins and serotonin reuptake inhibitors. We had fallen into one of our periodic comas of obesity and celebrity when the sniper went off like an alarm clock, and the preacher on TV said that he had come according to Revelation 3:14 to punish us for the crime of not being ready for death. But as Snoopy the clerk at the 7-Eleven said, what kind of crime is that? Meanwhile, the air conditioners are working overtime. The rooftops are full of SWAT teams and camera crews, and the sky, too, is mobilizing. Dark clouds without speaking, menacing millennial clouds. We don't know yet what the metaphysical facts are. We don't know if our sniper is domestic or foreign terror, what color the chip on his shoulder is, or what we will do if the sniper chooses us tomorrow. But when we walk out now, we feel our nakedness. Each step has a slender string attached. And when we move more quietly as we slide between the sinners and the snipers and the summer in the simmering medicinal rain.
Responses to that poem?
We were in Washington, D.C. For a high school reunion for him, the sniper was out. And we've been to D.C. Many, many times. His dad and mom lived there. And we were actually so terrified. We did go to the reunion. We were going to hang out in Washington and do things that we like to do. We went to Cape Cod. We'd never been there. But there was so much tension that everyone was afraid, like, to go to the monuments. Would that be a place? And in addition, the sniper had been seen carrying a trombone case, rumor. He was carrying a trombone case, so that did it for us. We thought we'd either get shot or, you know, be shot. It was absolutely the weirdest thing I've ever seen. It was just that one person could do that.
You could sense that. I mean, the weather stuff was going on there with this. Like, the terror is something that seems to get into the air. We can almost smell it. Other responses to that poem?
I've got the exact line with the punch us for the sin of not being ready for death. You know, that. Yeah, I mean, but as Snoopy the cleric had something to do, but what kind of a sin is that? I think that basic question is behind so much of our response to or lack of ability to respond to something that is terrifying.
Yeah,
you know, because it's a reminder, it's a prefiguring of that ultimate terror, which is the end, our own end, cosmic end, cultural end, and you know, chaos seems to stand in for that.
Yeah. Well said. And like this, the heart of this poem is this litany of voices that each has a different interpretation of the terror, and you can see how that each one leads down a different ethical path, a different spiritual path, a different way to be in the world. So terror kind of pushes us to that edge. Is that kind of what you're saying? And of course,
our response to terror, it can be analogous to response to, in other words, death, chaos.
Yeah.
And so, ultimately, death.
Yeah. So it seems like the really, like, to me, the important moment is just that what all of those are coming from is that terror reminds us of our own nakedness and our own complete vulnerability. And so, when you're talking about, you know, what we're attending to, you know, like, are we able to sit with our own nakedness and vulnerability, or do we immediately have to, like, figure out how we're going to, like, put on the armor to protect that, you know?
Yeah, well said. That's stunning. I think that's really beautiful. One thought just flew right out there. One of the church's ancient traditions is on Ash Wednesday. One of the monastic traditions was to come to that service barefoot. For a lot of different reasons. One is that you're buried barefoot, usually. And then to have those ashes put on there. That's one little hint of a liturgical moment that can form us for when this terror befalls us, unbidden, when it breaks into our lives. What this poem also helps me think about is that in those moments when you sniff that air and the terror is all around, our instincts can be, you know, get the first aid kit and do all these things, and probably important and good. But what I'm hearing in Tony Hoagland's poem and some of this other stuff is that it's a time to go to our deepest place, to listen to the deepest treasures of our faith, the deepest words that we have from God. And some of that stuff is going to get in our bones over time through repeated practices in liturgy and in prayer. And if we haven't gotten to that point when terror strikes, we have less instincts to deal with it. Makes sense.
You know, it's interesting, Ben, to see how that's maybe formed in ways that we're not conscious of. I mean, you think about probably the most common bedtime prayer for children is, "Now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep, and then if I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take." That there's this preparing for death. When you graduate from that prayer, you often, at least historically, there's a hymn in the church that was sung at night, "Teach me to live that I may dread, the grave as little as the bed."
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean that there's this constant, you know, preparation for the appropriate response to the terror, that is embracing of God. You know?
Yes, yeah, wonderful. Maybe Mark will read us from a hymn later on that I know he has some affection for, an evening hymn. That's a monastic liturgical practice, that every night you kind of prepare for death peacefully, and every morning you celebrate resurrection. Yeah, we'll say. Let's read another thing here. Let me see what else is on this list. Marcus, you want to read the Job stuff?
That was around chapter 38.
Yeah. Here's another mix of beauty and terror and God all together, and ultimately a shut-up mouth.
This is probably familiar to most of you. Job chapter 38. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy? Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed bounds for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far shall you come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stopped." Look further on. "Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? What is the way to the place where the light is distributed, or where the east wind is scattered upon the earth? Who has cut a channel for the torrents of rain and a way for the thunderbolt, to bring rain on a land where no one lives, on the desert which is empty of human life, to satisfy the waste and desolate land, and to make the ground put forth grass? Has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb did the ice come forth? And who has given birth to the hoar frost of heaven? The waters become hard like a stone, and the face of the deep is frozen." "Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook, or press down its tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in its nose, or pierce its jaw with a hook? Will it make many supplications to you? Will it speak soft words to you? Will it make a covenant with you to be taken as your servant forever? Will you play with it as with a bird? Or will you put it on a leash for your girls? Will traders bargain over it? Will they divide it up among the merchants? Can you fill its skin with harpoons or its head with fishing spears? Lay hands on it. Think of the battle. You will not do it again. Any hope of capturing it will be disappointed, were not even the gods overwhelmed at the sight of it. No one is so fierce as to dare to stir it up. Who can stand before it? Who can confront it and be safe? Unto the whole heaven, who?" Then Job answered the Lord, "I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you declare to me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes."
Responses to that, to Job's, to God's speech to Job. First section, full of the beauty of the earth, just the splendor of creation, and then shifts to Leviathan. Do you know, Leviathan is this mythological dragon monster in the sea that kind of symbolizes death, symbolizes chaos, and God kind of taunts Job, saying, got a handle on that? Got a fish hook on Leviathan? I don't think so. Leviathan's going to swallow everybody in the end. And Job kind of backs off and stands before God in this prayerful stance with his mouth kind of closed, finally. Hands like this. I want to read something from Andy Dillard. This is a favorite passage of mine about liturgy and beauty and terror. It explains itself. She's kind of on retreat, not so far from here, and she's begun attending a small Congregationalist church. She's mostly an Episcopalian herself. But the churchwomen all bring flowers for the altar, and they haul in arrangements as big as hedges of wayside herbs and seasons and flowers from the gardens, huge bunches of foliage and blossoms as tall as I am, and vases the sizes of tubs. And the altar still looks empty, irredeemably linoleum and beige. We had a wretched singer once, a guest from a Canadian congregation, a hulking blonde girl with chopped hair and big shoulders who wore tinted spectacles and a long lacy dress and sang, grinning, to faltering accompaniment, an entirely secular song about mountains. Nothing could have been more apparent than that God loved this girl. Nothing could more surely convince me of God's unending mercy than the continued existence on earth of the church. The higher Christian churches, where if anywhere I belong, come at God with an unwarranted air of professionalism, with authority and pomp, as though they knew what they were doing, as though people in themselves were an appropriate set of creatures to have dealings with God. I often think of set pieces of liturgy as certain words which people have successfully addressed to God without their getting killed. In the high churches, they saunter through the liturgy like mohawks along a strand of scaffolding who have long since forgotten their danger. If God were to blast such a service to bits, the congregation would be, I believe, genuinely shocked. But in the low churches, you expect it at any minute. She says, this is the beginning of wisdom. Let me read, on behalf of some of those so-called higher churches, let me read from this contemporary adaptation of an ancient litany from the Eastern Church. Just a lot of repeated prayers for God's mercy. And then these petitions. From all sin, from all error, from all evil, from all cunning assaults of the devil, from an unprepared and evil death, spare us, good Lord. From war, bloodshed, and violence, from corrupt and unjust government, from sedition and treason, spare us, good Lord. From epidemic, drought, and famine, from fire and flood, earthquake, lightning, and storm, and from everlasting death, spare us, good Lord. There's one that kind of lists all the beauty and the goodness of creation, and then back to this kind of list that I think people who might be, could be terrorized by the world. To behold and help all who are in danger, need, or tribulation. To protect and guide all who travel. To preserve and provide for all women in childbirth. To watch over children and to guide the young. To heal the sick and to strengthen their families and friends. To bring reconciliation to families in discord. To provide for the unemployed and for all in need. To be merciful to all who are imprisoned. To support, comfort, and guide all orphans, widowers, and widows. And to have mercy on all your people. And then we implore you to hear us, good Lord. What's your sense? Does liturgy prepare us for this now?
I have a comment that kind of goes back to what you said about this need to control in a situation that is so completely out of control. And I think often we think of coming to church as a place of comfort, a place of strength, a place of support, which it is. But how we feel when something happens to the order of things in church and how deeply unsettling that can be. A couple of years ago, someone wandered into our church. I think it was a schizophrenic guy. He got up and started walking up and down the aisles and talking and in the middle of the service. we were doing our service. We were following the order of worship. And it really shook people up. Nothing bad happened, but I think people were afraid. I think people were afraid that he was going to be violent. People were unsettled because we had a time schedule to follow. We had another service coming up, of course.
Yeah.
And just, I was struck by what you read about, this church that has, you just can't cover up this ugly altar with all the flowers. And we just have, even in our worship, we have this desire to lasso and rein in and control our encounter with God. We want it to be neat and tidy. We want it to be spiritually uplifting and inspirational. And we want it to be what we want it to be.
Yeah.
And when something comes in that's not quite right, maybe the singer's off key and it bothers us, or some crazy guy walks in up the street. It was a profound lesson, I think, for the congregation.
Perfect image of how one person entering a room can kind of expose how fragile the order that was there is, and how kind of how thin it can be. Yeah, Lynn.
I have a friend, a pastor, who, when you're talking about attends, always attends to what isn't happening or who isn't being heard. And so she's very, in a sense, very free in her service, because she had sort of a similar thing happen. She was in the middle of preaching, and a guy wanders into the church, and he said, "I have a word from the Lord. I have a word from the Lord." Everybody just, got very nervous. And she stopped, and she said, "We always want to hear a word from the Lord. Come on up, brother, and tell us your word." And it was so amazing, because then he talked a little bit, and she said, "Good. And this is what I heard you say. Now you sit down there, and I'm going to tell you what my word is." And he sat down, but she really believes. That's what was so, about the stranger or the voice that isn't heard in the service. And she's always paying attention to where that voice may erupt. And then she gives it room. And it's just, when I think about my own tight control issues.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. That's really amazing. Yeah.
Mark, the religious community that I've participated in is a Roman Catholic parish in Cleveland, and it's downtown, and people wander off the streets all the time, and we administer the elements of the Eucharist by the common cup. And so you have your affluent suburbanites who are coming downtown, taking the common cup right behind Mr. Homeless Man, off the streets, reeking probably, and taking the cup, having a sip, passing it back, wiping it off, next person taking it, and there's a beauty to that. In a sense, it's within the rubric of control. Everyone is doing what they are supposed to be doing, but it. Challenges that sense of the cup. It's beautiful, yes, but when someone who I won't say isn't supposed to be there, but when someone who you all know what I mean. But it's a fascinating way of challenging that. I won't call it beauty and terror.
There's some terror there. Taking a cup after someone.
Sure. I mean, not for me, but for some people, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Part of the ministry of one of the phrases that people said about Jesus is that he got killed for the way he ate, because he ate with. Sometimes at best, folks who are homeless. I mean, Jesus himself says he has nowhere to lay his head, but. Lepers, all these unclean, impure people at table. Gail Ramshaw says that a lot of our finickiness about the common cup, sure, we say it's about health, but the word purity is also the same word that got Jesus in trouble. You're breaking purity laws at the table. Don't eat with these people. So she says that just there's a deep human, maybe not terror would be the word she used, but aversion to sharing a cup with others. And yeah, it sounds like for your parish at least, there's a sense of, okay, this is it, you know, we're gonna drink this together. I've heard anyway, shaking hands is an easier way to share germs than drinking from the same cup, so qualified.
Okay. I wonder too if the other side of the coin in terms of liturgy making us feel, you know, uptight about things is that also it seems like in moments of crisis and things getting out of control, that I bet we've all experienced times in our lives where like saying a prayer or a specific way that things are done has totally stepped in as a means of like as attending to that terror of like, you know, you come across a broken body or whatever, you know, whoever it is that's in a time of need, and saying a prayer or that ritual or liturgy coming back to lend some sort of calm to
Well said. I mean, we probably all had that experience. A classmate of mine, senior year of seminary, promising church leader, just one morning died of a heart attack, you know, a few months shy of graduation, and I had nothing. I had no words, no way to make sense of it. But coming into the chapel and singing, you know, this is the feast of victory for our God, the Lamb who was slain. I had words to sing, and the universe with its pain in there, the slain Lamb, in some wretched ways, made sense again. And somebody gets, I thought I had something. Another prayer that I've heard, and we've talked a lot about terror now, but also about beauty, the overwhelmingness of beauty. I took my brother once hiking at Glacier National Park where I was living, and we came over this first mountain pass. This boy from Ohio had come over, and actually, a stream of profanity issued from his lips because he was so overwhelmed. he did not know what to say. So the church could help him find better words. My mentor in Philadelphia talks about when he comes across a beautiful animal or a plant, he has a prayer. I can't remember the exact words, but it's something like, thank you, God, for the beauty of this creature and for all of its kind. Help and preserve it on this earth. And just that this fern, this deer, this specific species, he tries to give thanks for and cultivate a spirit that attends that. One more point about that. The secular philosopher Wittgenstein says that people who are grateful actually experience a different universe than other people. You really do see different things if you've cultivated a habit of thanksgiving for the earth around. You will see things that other people don't. Liturgy can help train us in that.
My father grew up in Iowa and Minnesota, and when he came to visit me in California, we took him up through the redwoods and through the big trees and through the sequoia. And we're standing looking at these huge trees, and he said, how can anybody doubt there's a God when you see something like this?
Yeah.
He was just overwhelmed.
Yeah. But there are ways, aren't there? I mean, we could do that. If we see trees, you know how many board feet are in that tree? You know how much it'd be worth? You know, that's a kind of trained response to it, isn't it? You know?
Not for me.
Not for you, no. But I'm saying the way we see those trees is largely a matter of, you know, how do we come to see this again? What are those, when we see the ocean, do we just see salmon harvesting or, you know, something like that? But do we raise our hands and say, thank you, God, for this amazing tree in this ocean?
And to return to your model and your hopes for liturgy, they are a result of what we have been attending to previous to this, knowingly or not. You know, as Bob Dylan sings, you've got to serve somebody, or everyone has got to serve somebody, whether one knows it or not. So if you've been thinking purely about board feet, then you will see that in the tree, perhaps before you are struck dumb with cosmic beauty.
I wonder if we can think about in liturgy, This might be, well, let's see. Are there moments that you can remember, you don't have to have a theological meaning for them, but where you've seen real beauty in church?
I'll be Darth Vader.
All right.
Oh, that's terrible.
Are you familiar with the hymn, Day is Dying in the West? Heaven is touching earth with rest. Wait and worship while the night sets its evening lamps alight throughout the sky. Holy, 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 Lord God Most High. Heaven and earth are full of thee. Heaven and earth are praising thee, O Lord Most High. That was our favorite song to sing around a campfire when I was in Luther League.
Wonderful. Thank you. Sounds like you sang that more than once.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful. A pretty tune also.
Mm-hmm. So you get the vision of
the sky.
God enfolding this whole earth and the sun coming around the earth. That's amazing. Yeah. Are the people seeing beauty in liturgy?
Beautiful Savior.
Beautiful Savior, yeah, yeah. And that again, looks at Jesus and also looks at the landscape all around, too. Yeah. I think of baptisms. Baptisms are just beautiful to me. Usually the more water, the better, but it almost doesn't matter. People just look beautiful. And to see mercy cascading over a body. That's all of our hope, I think, right there.
The part of the daily office of Compline, it often moves me greatly. It's probably because it has such a strong measure of terror mixed in with its beauty, or at least of naming terror. Death, night, end of the day. You're dark, you know, all of these things wrapped up. And ritually treating them in language, naming them and holding them within the greater cosmic mystery of God, in which we all are. And it's such a mixture of litany, of, you know, repetition of word and phrase, and then tossing some readings and some hymns as well. But it's a wonderful sense of form, naming and containing chaos.
Yeah, excellent. I just visited some friends who also had some kids that were my children's age, and they were talking about some birds that had hit the window of their preschool, and all the kids were with our children. They were here, and she said, and the mother said, but luckily the bird didn't die. And I realized she didn't want to say the word die or death in front of her kids. And it sounds like what we're saying, what we're talking about today is, you know, death is going to befall us. It's going to happen. And what liturgy and our lives can do is attend to it in ways, Mark called it contained. I mean, that we can attend to it kind of in a safe way, so that when it does come, our world may be ripped apart, but we at least have faith that it will be put back together again. I mean, Jesus' whole world was ripped apart. The heavens were torn open above Jesus' crucifixion. And yet we kind of know that story. I'm waiting for when this young girl, wonders where George Washington is or something. You know, where did all these people go, all these great heroes? They haven't died yet.
Ben, I had another comment about liturgy. I think another place I've found power and beauty is in silence. And I think it's something that we are often afraid of. I think we do feel the need to contain, to name. And sometimes, actually, I was thinking about 9/11, whoever said that, and we had a service just of silence. Just of silence, we had a set beginning and a set end, but no words were spoken. And it was one of the most powerful healing places, because there simply were no words for it. Just, there weren't any.
There's a deep wisdom in that. You can measure, you can be formed in your weekly worship too, with points of silence. Mm-hmm. Hard to do sometimes with children, but children too can learn that. And that's a learned response to events. Just before you go off with the megaphone, to sit in silence for a while.
At our church, after those of us who had been to Holden, we started using the Holden service, the evening service.
Oh, yeah.
And it was kind of interesting because, well, we use it during Lent, especially for, we have two services for the later service. And so there were many people who had never heard it until more recently we have started, well, it's been a few years now, a Saturday service, Saturday evening. And so our new pastor, it's been here 2 years now, he started using it for the Saturday night service. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of people who, more elderly people, who hadn't heard it before, and they just thought it was the most wonderful thing they'd ever heard. And these are the people who think you don't want to change, you know, they want that, and they just thought that, to me, I love that service.
Yeah.
We don't use it, you know, every week, but when we use it, it's just a very...
Yeah, that service certainly attends to beauty all around.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's the quiet moments in it, like you were saying.
I just when you were talking about it, I never thought about this before, but one of the most powerful services for me, I used to go to the evening worship service at the Metropolitan Community Church in San Francisco in the 80s. And this was a church of gay and lesbian people. And a third of the congregation was dying at one moment.
Mm-hmm.
And every week they announced another death, and they were people who were in their 20s and 30s. So this was an incredible congregation in grief. But their Sunday night service was the most joyous service I ever attended. And when you started singing the songs, every word had meaning. And it's sort of like, when terror is right there, the words are so powerful.
Yeah.
Because we're living in the midst of death.
Yeah.
And yet they were singing full of joy.
Yeah.
And so I believed them.
Yeah.
I believed their joy in a way I often don't.
Yeah. Well, that's excellent, yeah. Similarly, I heard a story about some refugees, I think it was in South America, who had been kicked out of their country and were kind of all together and had to organize themselves. And they had a food committee, food and water committee, they had a shelter committee, and they had a joy committee. These refugees out there realized that they needed to cultivate that. They needed, you know, they were going to be able to attend to terror all around them, but the joy was going to have to be a habit to sing resurrection in this moment. But there, yeah, it does, it's there's something that you begin to believe even deeper at that point. Yeah, well said.
There's also, this is like a more specific one, but I think it's so cool about being at Holden because I've never gotten to be on this side of things. So if you get a chance on Sunday, it's to sit yourself in a spot where you can watch people's faces when they come up to take communion. Because, I mean, I've, you know, never gotten to distribute it, but I don't know, like there's something that crosses people's face in that moment, I think, before when they put their hands out and when that's just really, it's really beautiful. And, I mean, not always, but I don't know. I think it's really.
No, that's nice. Yeah, and you know what? More than bread and wine are such rich symbols of beauty, of nourishment, and also terror. Because if you don't have it, you die. Too much wine is deadly. Maybe fun for a while, but deadly. Yeah, and then the theological unfolding of those and the mysteries that you can't name.
I think of a related act. You know, when I think of beauty and terror and liturgy, I think of my wedding. You know that.
Well said. Yes.
No, I cried like a slapped baby while saying my vows to Lisa, and everyone thought it was very sweet that I was able to, you know, show how happy I was, but I was just terrified. I really was. I was so scared.
Yeah.
But I trusted my sober judgment and my years of discernment. You know, what I had been formed in, so I had what I consider to be an appropriate response to that terror. You know, not running and screaming, but mustering my way through these vows that I thought were important to say. And I'm happy I said them, don't get me wrong. But in terms of, you know, fostering appropriate Christian responses to terror and living in hope, you know, with the expectation of beauty, you see that at the wedding service.
Yeah.
You know, you really do.
Yeah, oh, that's a beautiful image. Yeah, kind of blubbering through the vows, sticking with the liturgy. Yeah. Wow, there went another thought. Shoo! Somebody else.
I was just kind of going back in time to, I grew up in a family where death wasn't really discussed. And if I don't think I ever went to funerals, but if I ever did, they would have been in a funeral parlor.
Mm-hmm.
And when I married my husband, I don't remember when the first funeral was, but there was funeral after funeral after funeral, because all the extended family was there, and it was in the church, and they sang songs of celebration, and afterwards it was this big party. And to me, all that has become a meaningful ritual.
Yeah. In my first church, nobody died for like 2 years. And I remember thinking, we need a funeral. Somebody needs to croak. It has this way of pushing you, you know, Kierkegaard has this account of the people after church lounging through the park singing. Oh, wasn't that just a delightful service? Yeah, oh, the hymn singing, just, oh, I got goosebumps, and so nice, and, you know, oh, the children were so sweet. And Kierkegaard keeps saying, I want you to see that every moment you're out over 70 fathoms of water, and you could sink, you know, or you could be struck by the beauty and awe of being alive. And funerals have a way of getting us there. I do think this is interesting. There's a lot speaking of terror.
Right in those
fathoms. 70,000 fathoms. There are movements in the church, and God bless these movements for wanting to welcome the outsiders who want to make church look like, you know, a hotel or something, and make it completely comfortable and make liturgy kind of sing like a McDonald's commercial, and that easily to enter into. And, you know, I have a lot of questions about that, but the urge to welcome people in is holy and wonderful. But there was a woman here last week who talked about when she was going through some problems in her life, and when she went to churches like this, there was just nothing there, because she knew that she stood over 70,000 fathoms and was worried that she was sinking fast and needed a place that could be honest about that holy mystery. So, not wanting to thump people over the head with sledgehammers, because people don't need to be reminded too often that life is hard, and we just kind of need to name it gently in our liturgy, but that can be a way of praying deeply and honestly. So,
one of the most vivid memories I have growing up, I was going to vacation Bible school, and we rode home with a lady who dropped us off, and my 5-year-old cousin got out of the car, ran across the street, a motorcycle came along, hit her and killed her. They had the funeral 3 days later, and the vacation Bible school was still going on. This is a beautiful little 5-year-old cousin. And the Sunday, the vacation Bible school children came in and sang "Children of the Heavenly Father." Mm-hmm. Just really amazing.
Yeah. Thank you.
Ben, I'm going to put you on the spot talking about this. You said it in the preface of one of your presentations, that it may have been yesterday, but you're or today. Your son's best friend died. It was today. Yesterday.
No, it was today. That's okay.
Anyway, how did you? I, you know, you sort of brushed over that, but tell me how you dealt with that with a child.
With your own child.
With Justin. He was still, he was three at that time. So the concepts were pretty difficult for him. But the big question he had was, will I see Bjorn again? And we kind of just, Bjorn is resting in God. And Beth and I actually had a lot of discussions. We could talk more about that, about how to talk about whether or not you're going to see your friend, because Justin doesn't know how to contemplate eternity. If we say yes, he is going to see him tomorrow or something.
Yeah.
So what we did do, though, is came to Compline that night, and we sang about death and mostly blubbered through singing about that. And then went to the funeral, went to the place where Bjorn died. And I think then over time, even after that, continued to talk about, to point out the prayers for all who die in the liturgy. I don't know if I have any... the other thing I guess I would just say is that part of what I think the liturgy can help us do is realize that when death like that befalls us, just to name that, it's awful. It's awful. And God also had a child die, and horribly, at a young age. And God understands that. So God is with us in those moments.
I was thinking he was older than that. But for a three-year-old, that's as much as that.
Yeah.
When I was three, actually when I was two, my younger brother died. And my parents told me that I went looking for him. They told me he had gone to heaven. And I went looking for him all over the house and in the neighborhood. And when I couldn't find him, I came back and said, I want to go where Eddie went. And that made it even worse for them. But that was my first experience that there was a better place that we would go. And that God loves us so much that he would bring us there.
I wish I had some last word to say here, but I'm not sure. Well, let's do this one. Here's another Tony Hoagland. Kata, do you want to have the last word on Honda Pavarotti?
I think you should do your own
study. I'll read this. Here's kind of the, not quite Beauty and Terror, but between Beauty and, well, I won't preface more than that. I think it speaks, though, to what we're talking about. Honda Pavarotti. I'm driving on the dark highway when the opera singer on the radio opens his great mouth and the whole car plunges down the canyon of his throat. So the night becomes an aria of stars and exit signs as I steer through the galleries of one dilated Italian syllable after another. I love the passages in which the rich flood of the baritone strains out against the walls of the esophagus. And I love the pauses in which I hear the tenor's flesh labor to inhale enough oxygen to take the next plummet up into the chasm of the violins. In part of the song, it sounds as if the singer is being squeezed by an enormous pair of tongs while his head and legs keep kicking. In part of the song, it sounds as if he is standing in the middle of a coliseum, swinging a 300-pound lion by the tail, the empire of gravity conquered by the empire of aerodynamics, the citadel of pride in flames, and the citizens of weakness celebrating their defeat in chorus. Joy and suffering made one at last. Joined in everything a marriage is alleged to be. Though I know the woman he is singing for is dead in a foreign language on the stage beside him, though I know his chainmail is made of silver-painted plastic and his mismanagement of money is legendary, as I know I have squandered most of my own life, in a haze of trivial distractions, and that I will continue to waste it. But wherever I was going, I don't care anymore, because no place I could arrive at is good enough for this. This thing made out of experience, but to which experience will never measure up. And that dark and soaring fact is enough to make me renounce the whole world, or fall in love with it forever. On the hinge between beauty and terror, hope and despair. We're not going to wrap this one up. It's a big one. So, thanks.